If you can remember from last week going through chapter 37, you saw it end with Jacob being completely tricked in terms of his sons have sold off Joseph, who's being carried down to Egypt. You see that they have taken his multicolored coat and have killed an animal, basically put the blood on that coat, taken it to their father and asked, "Is this your son's?" Wanting him to go ahead and assume that he had been killed by a wild beast. And whenever he mourned greatly over him, they never said anything to bring him great comfort in terms of the truth. And in those moments, it's real easy to look at Jacob and to really feel sorry for him, to have sons that would rather him be fooled that his favorite son has died, even though he still lives. And yet at the same time, we have to remember, we keep on going back to the same principle in Galatians chapter 6 about God is not mocked, don't be deceived. What a man sows, he's also going to reap. Was Jacob not a man of trickery? And how he stole the blessing from his brother Esau. And now, all of a sudden, what he did in terms of deceit and trickery, now he is receiving back from his own sons. And it doesn't mean we shouldn't have compassion, but understand there are plenty of times where you get to see the difficulties that people go through, and it's because they're just reaping what they sowed. And we're hoping that they come to a faith toward God and a contrite heart. Now, as those things take place, we're going to continue to see some trickery as it comes through into chapter 38, but the story is going to change quite a bit. But before we get to that, I want to ask you a question. In Matthew chapter 1 and in Luke chapter 3, it talks about the genealogy of Jesus. And in Matthew's account, it gives you four women who are part of the genealogy of Jesus, from Abraham all the way down to Jesus himself. Can you tell me who those four women are? Bathsheba, Tamar, Rahab, and Ruth. Now, out of those four, and if you start dealing with them in terms of chronological order, what we're going to look at in chapter 38 is going to be Tamar. And, of course, understand, you might be wondering if you've ever set out to just read through the Bible in a year, or maybe you wanted to read through Genesis, and all of a sudden you start on Joseph, and then you get to chapter 38 and go, what in the world is going on here, and why is this even here? And you understand it's because God knows you need to understand, and the record needs to be straight, to understand about this being, in terms of Jesus, a direct descendant of Abraham because of the promises that are made in Genesis about through him, all the nations will be blessed. And so it makes sure that you understand how these things take place. In seeing that, all four of those women are considered to be black sheep to the Jews. Now, all of those you would probably easily think the same except for maybe one. But going, the story is going to happen with Tamar tonight in chapter 38. There'll be parts of this story, if you haven't read it before, that you go, it's hard to believe this is God's people. And yet to understand, God can use flawed people, even evil people, to still achieve his purpose, even if they don't know it. Then, of course, we talked about in terms of Tamar. Then you start working your way down and you run into a woman by the name of Rahab. What's so despised about Rahab in the minds of the Jews? She's a harlot and she's a Canaanite. She's not even Jewish. And so here's a harlot that's going to be taken in, and this is going to be someone who's later on Jesus is going to be a descendant of. And of course, if you remember Rahab, is going to marry a man by the name of Salmon, and then they're going to have a son by the name of Boaz. And, of course, who is Boaz going to marry? Ruth. The Jews are going to look down on Ruth because what's her heritage? She's a Moabite woman. And if you remember the story that we've already read in Genesis, that after Lot is spared along with his two daughters from the destruction of Sodom. His two daughters get Lot drunk so that they can be pregnant by their father. Disgusting. And then they give birth to two children, and one of them is Moab. And so you see the descendants come through there, and God even makes a statement in Deuteronomy about there will be no Moabites in the assembly of the Lord for 10 generations. Anybody want to guess how many generations it is for Ruth? 10 or 11. So you start realizing God knows exactly what's going to happen, and he lays it out exactly beforehand. So whenever it happens, you go, oh, look, God already knew that. Then, of course, you come down to the next woman in the genealogy of Jesus, and you run into Bathsheba. I don't think there's any doubt in our mind why she would be considered a black sheep in the family. And I use that term just kind of loosely. But understand, here she is. She commits adultery against her own husband with the king, David. And yet God's still going to use her. And you start to look through these situations that take place, and you see what's going on. And so you come back here to Genesis 38, and here's Judah. And Judah is 24 generations removed from Adam. So in the annals of time, as things progress forward, here we are, the 24th generation. Noah was the 10th generation. So we've come quite a way since the flood. Chapter 38 opens this way. And it came about at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Now, at the beginning of Genesis 39, Jacob is about 108 years old whenever Joseph is 17. So this is sometime after that age, but realize he's over the age of 108 now. And here's Judah, whose last words, if you look back at chapter 37, look at verse 26. This is the sparkling life of Judah. It says, Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? And of course, he goes on to say, let's sell him and at least make some money. That tells you a little bit about where Judah's heart was in this. He says, well, there's no profit in killing him. He says, maybe we can make some money. I think you'll see something similar in terms of his aims and goals as we keep on reading chapter 38. So here he is. Judah departs from his brothers. Remember, they were up in Dothan, way up north. And so he kind of starts to settle in his own place. Says he visited a certain Adullamite. Adullamite is just somebody who's from the town of Adulla. Is that right? Yeah. And so Adullam, he says, whose name was Hira. He has this great friend named Hira. You're going to see him show up again later. Verse 2, I say great friend in the sense of he's loyal, not great in the sense of he makes good choices. Verse 2. Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her. Now, Shua is a male name. So understand here when it says a certain Canaanite, talking about the Canaanite daughter as well as her father, whose name was Shua. Shua in Hebrew literally means wealthy or prosperous. It even means opulent, like extremely wealthy. And so you can kind of see for Judah, he's like, maybe if I marry the daughter of a man who's known for his wealth, this could turn out good for me. It kind of starts to show a little linear idea about what Judah's in this for, doesn't it? He wanted to sell his brother for money rather than kill him, not because he had a tender heart. And all of a sudden you see he's going to marry a Canaanite man's daughter whose name Shua means opulent. And notice it doesn't say anything about them being married. Don't take that either way as yes or no, but it just doesn't mention that. It says, and he took her and went into her. So he knows her in terms of a physical way. Verse 3. So she conceived and bore a son, and his name was Ur. Now, I've never met somebody named Ur in all my life, other than what's here. But here's the other aspect of this. The Hebrew name Ur, I'm not going to say what it literally means because it's pretty disgusting. But the tame version of what I can tell you is he's a wild donkey. If that gives you an idea. I mean, they give him that name. And so here he is, and he's described not only here, but over in First Chronicles as being wicked, being evil. Verse 4. Then she conceived again and bore a son and named him Onan. Now, Onan is a name that means trouble. I don't know if you ever make fun of people, but sometimes you might say kiddingly, oh, here comes trouble. Well, you might as well name him Onan, because that's literally what it means. So that tells you a little something else. It says, then she conceived again, bore a son, named him Onan. Verse 5, she bore still another son and named him Shelah, or Shelah is probably what it would actually be pronounced. And in that name just means prosperity. So you kind of get a different feel here for the third son, Shelah. And it was at Chezeb that she bore him. Now, Chezeb is an interesting little name, too. It's a town, of course, and it literally means deceitful or lying. Isn't that quite a town to be from? A town that's known for deceit and lying. And it even if it was applied to a stream, it would mean the stream is dry, like it has nothing to offer. So here's what's at hand. Here's kind of our setting. Don't worry, it's going to go downhill from here. He says, and she bore him. Verse 6. Now Judah took a wife from Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. And so all of a sudden this story gets introduced, and now all of a sudden these boys are already grown up. Things are moving pretty fast in the chapter, and he's of age to marry. And so he finds a woman whose name is Tamar. Verse 7. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the covenant God, the Lord. So the Lord took his life. Well, what does that tell you about the Lord? I mean, Ur's name literally means a wild donkey, but it kind of is an apt description of him from the sounds of it. He's so wicked that God says, I'm not going to allow you to be part of the lineage of my son. And he killed it. Now, then it moves on a little bit further. Verse 8. Then Judah said to Onan, remember Onan's the second son. He says, go in to your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother. This is kind of an interesting practice. Now, we'll go over and look at Deuteronomy here in a second, and you'll see it under the Old Covenant that this is what they did. If your older brother got married, had no children of his own, it was the responsibility of the next oldest son to actually pass on the seed to his wife so that she could conceive a child and the name would live on. Now, you might start thinking about this and go, ooh, that sounds really, really weird and really odd. Because it is. Here's the other aspect. If I was still under that kind of covenant, I'd be really concerned about who my older brother married. Wouldn't you? All of a sudden, you'd care a whole lot more about who he dates and who he's going to marry. But it's not Onan's choice. And he's a troublemaker as it is. That's why he has the name. Now, real quickly, let's go look over at the Old Covenant. Look at Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 25. Deuteronomy chapter 25, look down at verse 5. When brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, that is the key here, has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. He says, it shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of her dead brother, of his dead brother, sorry, so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. So what is this practice all about? family name. It's about lineage, right? That is what this is completely tied around. So, you see this principle? Verse 7. But if the man does not desire to take his brother's wife, you think that could ever happen? Whew. He says, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. He is not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Now, you kind of imagine this conversation taking place and going, he's not honoring the covenant. And I know this sounds rather odd, because it is, but notice how it continues on. Verse 8. Some of the questions that elders get asked. I mean, you look at some of these things. He says, then the elders of his city shall summon him. Now, notice it's the elders of his city, wherever he lives. He says, they're localized. He says, shall summon him. He has to come to where they are. He says, and speak to him. And if he persists and says, I do not desire to take her, here he's come before the elders, and he still doesn't want to do what's honoring of this old covenant. He says, notice how it continues on, verse 9. Then his brother's wife shall come to him in the sight of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. Ooh. Now, I don't know if you've ever had somebody spit on you. If you have, I'm sure it wasn't very nice, unless it was unintentional. But the feeling of warm saliva going down your face is not something that's comforting or feels good. And notice, did he earn it? He's chosen not to honor God's covenant. This is what his duty is. Now, notice how this continues on. Shall spit in his face, and she shall declare. She's going to make a declaration here. Thus it is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. Now, this was not just something that, oh, well, it's okay. This is, you are going against the very covenant that you said you were going to honor. To raise up a name for your brother in this child. And as you think about this, there's parallels here with Jesus in terms of Jesus was spit upon. And what was he bearing for us when he was spit upon? He was bearing our curse, right? Mark 14 talks about it, that they spit upon him. There's even a prophecy about it in Isaiah chapter 50, verse 6, where it talks about, well, I'll just read it to you real quick. I gave my back to those who strike me, and my cheek to those who pluck out the beard. I did not cover my face from humiliation and spitting. He says, they hit me over and over again. And in what part did they hit Jesus over and over again? When he scourged. And to think, it was all in terms of humiliation to spit upon him. And there's a prophecy here about in terms of to pluck the beard out. If you're a man that has a beard, how good does it feel when somebody grabs some of that and pulls? Now, you realize Jesus was fulfilling these prophecies and being spit upon because he was bearing the curse for us. Now, here is part of a curse because he's not going to honor the covenant. That's why he's getting cursed in terms of what's here in Deuteronomy 25. And then notice verse 10. He says, in Israel, his name shall be called the house of him whose sandal is removed. And you go, oh, you're going to raise up children for yourself, but not for your brother, huh? Now, can you remember any other stories that this comes to a point in? Yeah, the story of Ruth and Boaz. If you look in Ruth chapter 4, you see the picture of Boaz steps forward to be the one who's going to take care of Ruth and her family, as well as Naomi, and to raise up children. And you see, once again, part of the lineage of Jesus. Same story. Now, come back over to Genesis chapter 38. So we've already seen Ur. The wild donkey has been killed by God because of how evil he is and wicked. Now you come to Onan, and Judah says, here's what you need to go do. Even though it's not part of the covenant yet, because we're before the times of Moses in that covenant. Then verse 9. Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So when he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. He says, well, we may have relations, but we're not going to do it in a way that you'd ever conceive. And you realize, wow, the hatred he has, and maybe you understand why his name's Onan, trouble. He is a troublemaker. And let's see if you reap what you sow. Verse 10. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, the covenant God. So he took his life also. Now Ur is dead. Now Onan has been killed. And it doesn't say how the Lord did it. It just says he's been killed. He's dead. Now, keep in mind, if you're in the wilderness, the children of Israel, you've received this covenant, the things that are written in, more so in Leviticus, in Exodus, Deuteronomy is not written until just a month or two before they cross over the Jordan River into the Promised Land. But going, what does this tell you about keeping these covenant promises with God? Do you take it lightly? No. What should this tell us about keeping the new covenant? Are these things vital? They certainly are. Now, with every covenant, there's blessings and cursings. We get to decide which way we want to walk, in faith or outside of faith. Notice how it continues on here. So the Lord took his life in terms of Onan. Verse 11. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. For he thought, I'm afraid that he too may die like his brothers. What did he think about Tamar? Oh, man, she's going to take all my sons down. He thought maybe she was cursed. He says, so Tamar went and lived in her father's house. So Tamar goes back home in the form of a widow to be taken care of by her father in her father's house again. You'll see there's clothes that go with this too. Verse 12. Now after a considerable time, and considerable time is years. We're not talking months. We're talking years. So now after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. So this would be Ur, Onan, and Shelah's mother has died. He says, and when the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. So Hira's still around. They go up to Timnah. Timnah's not very far from Chezeb. Then notice how it continues on here. Verse 13. It was told to Tamar, behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. Notice how still referred to as her father-in-law, not your former father-in-law, but your father-in-law. He says he's going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. And Timnah is, you do go up to Timnah. It's higher in elevation. Verse 14. So she removed her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in the gateway of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah had grown up, and she had not been given to him as a wife. Here she is, she sits. She sits clothed and veiled. She's taken off her widow's garments. And you can read a little bit more about those things kind of culturally. We might think in terms of someone who wears not necessarily long-sleeved things. Those are things of virgins. But here she is dressed in a certain way that they would easily identify her as a widow. She takes off those garments. She wraps herself up, concealed. She's veiled, so you wouldn't necessarily see her face. And she sits in this place, this city. It's on the way to Timnah, which is exactly where Judah's going and heading. And he's going there to shear sheep. Then says she also saw that his third son had grown up. Been a considerable amount of time now. Shelah is no longer a little boy. He's grown up. You might even call him a man. And yet she knows what happened. I was supposed to be given to him. He's supposed to raise up children for his oldest brother. Verse 15. And notice, apparently this was already a practice before you get to Deuteronomy 25, right? You can see how they're already thinking along those lines. Judah even tells his son to do this in terms of Onan. Then, verse 15. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. So notice, he can't tell who she is. And what does he assume? She's a harlot. She's a prostitute. Then, verse 16. Widowers don't do this. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, "Here now, let me come in to you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What will you give me that you may come in to me?" Now, I've never been part of a conversation like this, so I know nothing about it. But negotiation? In terms of saying, if you're going to be a prostitute, how much do I have to pay you? And notice, here's what he said. Verse 17. He said, "Therefore I will send you a young goat from the flock." He says, "I'll send you a young goat later." She's pretty cunning. Because I want you to notice what happens next. I'm not saying she's good, but she's cunning. She said, "Moreover, will you give a pledge until you send it? What's the guarantee that I have that you'll actually do that?" He says, "You have a pledge?" And then he says, verse 18, "What pledge shall I give you?" It's like, what could I give you? And what she comes up with, I don't know where she got it. She said, "Your seal and your cord and your staff that is in your hand." He says, "It's what you have right there." He says, "Give me your staff." What does every shepherd need? Staff. Going to be hard-pressed to do what he's supposed to do without that. He says, "Give me your seal that's only yours. Give me your cord." In whatever way that was unique. Then the rest of verse 18. So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. He said, "All right, you can keep these things until I pay you off with the young goat." And sure enough, here she is hired out. They do what you would expect. And then she actually conceives and has a child. Now, look at how this continues. Don't worry, it's going to get worse. Then, verse 19. Then she arose and departed and removed her veil and put on her widow's garments. She changes her clothes now that she's away from Judah. She takes off the clothes of the veil in terms of harlotry or prostitution, and then she puts on her widow's garments. Now, verse 20. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, here's Hira. Man, what a guy. In terms of, I can't even imagine this conversation. I just can't even imagine it. In terms of thinking, you know what, Hira, could you do me a favor? I want you to go and pay off this prostitute that I hired, and if you'll just take this young goat to her, make sure and get my things back, and then that'll be done. And if Hira was any kind of friend, he'd just tell him how stupid he was. He says, "You can take care of your foolishness yourself." But here's his friend, the Adullamite, to receive the pledge from the woman's hand. He says, he did not find her. All of a sudden, he can't find her. And you go, man, how evil things become and how they just get worse. I mean, you start looking through this story. Are you looking for the person to imitate? There's not anybody in here, right? I mean, tricking your father-in-law, being a troublemaker in Onan, being a wild donkey like Look at how it keeps on going. He doesn't find her. Verse 21. He asked the men of her place, saying, "Where is the temple prostitute who was by the road at Aneum?" But they said, "There's been no temple prostitute here." Has Hira, did you just send me on a wild goose chase? Is this all a made-up story? He knows it's not. And to go, how despicable to have to go look for this situation to begin with, and then to go, you can't even find her. Verse 22. So he returned to Judah and said, I did not find her. And furthermore, the men of the place said, there has been no temple prostitute here. He says, I think you've been duped. He didn't say it that way. But he says, I asked around. Nobody knew who in the world you were talking about. Verse 23. Then Judah said, let her keep them. Otherwise, we will become a laughingstock. See, Judah knew how much of an idiot he was in some sense. Not the whole sense, because he wouldn't have done it if he knew the whole sense. But notice, he says, if we keep on going around asking to find this woman, everybody's just going to laugh at us. He says, after all, I sent this young goat, but you did not find her. It's as if he says, you know, we tried. We tried to pay off the prostitute. Verse 24. Now, it was about 3 months later that Judah was informed, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot. And behold, she is also with child by harlotry. Oh, 3 months later. Now, you could already tell Judah wasn't real high on Tamar to begin with. Here's my first two sons who have died being married to you. I'm afraid to give you my third son because he might die too. Isn't it interesting how Judah processes things in those terms? When really, it's the evil of his sons that led to their demise. And here's Judah, who wasn't faithful to give his third son. And now here's Tamar, who's not faithful in tricking her own father-in-law into these things. And yet here he is, and you can kind of hear the condescending, self-righteous attitude here of going, he finds out Tamar's about 3 months pregnant. She's about through her first trimester, we would say. And his conclusion at the end of verse 24, then Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. He says, let's just burn her to the ground. Wow. You want to see the compassion of wicked people? He says, my life would be better if she was just burned and dead. Sure, she's got a child inside of her. Burn a child too. Ooh. And notice, Tamar has played the harlot. And behold, she is also a child by harlotry. He says, then Judah said, bring her out. Let her be burned. And there are two instances in the book of Leviticus where the penalty was to be burned. One of them is where a man marries both a mother and a daughter. He says, burn them all. And there's another situation that also happens in another place in Leviticus. And you go, here's these situations that take place. And they were very extreme situations. And for Judah to think this way, which also tells you, evil people are the most unrelenting people of all. And we had better be careful we're not part of that. Now, verse 25. It was while she was being brought out. Are you catching that? What were they going to do? They were going to burn her to death. Now, you think about all the agonizing ways to die. And I hope you don't spend a lot of time thinking about that. I don't know of anybody who wants to be burned to death. And you think, here she is, being led out to be burned to death. And notice what she says. She sent to her father-in-law saying, no, still calls him father-in-law. I am with child by the man to whom these things belong. Here's what she has. Seal, cord, and a staff. And she said, please examine and see whose signet ring and cords and staff are these. Ooh. Good thing she asked for a security. Verse 26. Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not have relations with her again. The realization hits. How did she get this way? And then all of a sudden he knew. This is because of my evil. Because I didn't give her my third son. This is me. It may not be this same kind of situation. But sometimes whenever we're caught in sin, finally, the truth comes out. And we have to decide what we're going to do. Are we going to stop playing the game? Are we going to say, you know what, I am a drunkard? Are we going to say, you know what, I'm not faithful to my mate? Are we going to say, you know what, I am a liar? You know what, I'm not a godly husband or a godly wife? And it hits you right in the face. And you have to decide in that moment, am I going to keep up the ruse? Or is it time for me to be honest and contrite? And Judah got hit right in the face. And you think about that moment. He was going to have to admit it before everybody. Because who is the one who called for her to be burned? He did. And now he's going to have to be the one to say, that child inside of her is mine. Of course, they never had relations again. And then notice how it goes on. Of course, she lives. And out of this is going to come something quite great. Verse 27. It came about at the time she was giving birth, some 6 months later, that behold, there were twins in her womb. Now, keep in mind, you know, nowadays you might find out you're having twins several months before you give birth. Back here, you didn't find that out too early. And yet, here it is, discovers that she has twins in her womb, verse 28. Moreover, it took place while she was giving birth. This is quite a story. One put out a hand. One of the twins put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. Oh, agonizing of a woman in labor. And then all of a sudden, here's a hand that comes out to tie a scarlet string around the hand and saying, this one's first. And then, of course, verse 29, but it came about as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother came out. Says, then she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. So he was named Perez, and that's what Perez means, is about breach. In other words, here's the child that seemed to be second, but now is first. Then, verse 30, afterward his brother came out, who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. And Zerah means a brightness or a rising or a dawn. Something new is coming. What you notice about this is God didn't just give Tamar one son. She gave him two. And you think there would be one son to raise up for her, and there would be one son to be raised up for Onan. All in one. Except for her and Onan are never mentioned as part of the lineage. It's all tied to Judah. And of course, when you flash forward and you start thinking about Jesus, hail, hail, O Lion of Judah. Here's the plan that God had in place before the foundations of the world, that this descendant was going to come through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and now Judah, and you look here at the lineage of Jesus and go, there's a lot of people here that were not pure in heart. They were not doing what was right. And yet God still achieved his purpose and his plan. Even in using people with wrong motives and wrong actions. And all of a sudden to bring these pictures together. And you may look at chapter 38 and go, why is that even there? This is such an odd story. But to realize, it's also that you can know that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the son of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, David, all the way down through till he's born in Bethlehem. And that is why that chapter is there in my mind, so that you can know beyond a shadow of a doubt how those things take place. Because I'm guessing nobody would be able to predict and guess that story if it wasn't written right there. All right. Lord willing, next week we'll come back to Joseph the rest of the way. Chapter 39. Have a good week.